Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mary Bitterman, Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Directors, President of the Bernard Osher Foundation, and immediate past Board Chair of the Public Broadcasting Service, better known as PBS. I'm pleased to introduce Paula Kerger, the sixth President and CEO of PBS, who began her tenure in March 2006. In this capacity, she directs the operations of the nation's largest non-commercial broadcasting service, comprising 355 member stations that reach more than 99% of American television households. Ms. Kerger came to PBS from the Educational Broadcasting Corporation, the parent company of 13 WNET and WLIW in New York, two of the largest public television stations in the country. At EBC since 1993, Ms. Kerger served most recently as Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer, involved in many program introductions and playing a major role within the national PBS system. She held earlier positions with the Metropolitan Opera, International House in New York, and the U.S. Committee for UNICEF. In its selection of Paula Kerger, the PBS board was able to find a person who values the mission of public broadcasting, is clear on its achievements, and is informed as to its promise. We were able to find an experienced manager, an articulate advocate, and strong proponent of education, a person excited about the opportunities of the digital age and the new role of public service media. We were also able to find a person connected to a larger world. Ladies and gentlemen, I present Paula Kerger.
Thank you and good evening. It's really a pleasure to visit with you tonight. The Commonwealth Club of California is, as America's oldest and largest public affairs forum, really does play an important role in our national discourse. And although California is part of the name of this organization, the impact extends far beyond the boundaries of this state. In many ways, this club and the organization that I'm so very proud to lead, the Public Broadcasting Service, share a common purpose. I look at the topics that other Commonwealth Club speakers are addressing this month, marriage equality, global poverty, the rise of Islam, and I see the very same subjects explored on PBS series such as The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Frontline, and Bill Moyers Journal. Not surprisingly, many of your speakers also come from the public television world. In fact, ironically, in the past 4 days, you've heard from Lynn Novick, who was Ken Burns' collaborator on the recent PBS documentary series, The War, and Rick Steves, whose cultural and travel programs are very much a public television staple. When you consider the Commonwealth Club's lineup of speakers and PBS's lineup of shows, it becomes clear we each exist to help Americans explore and understand the world around them. Our means may be different, but the end is the same. We both work towards a more enlightened and engaged citizenry. Tonight, I want to discuss how PBS is honoring this commitment in the 21st century. I'd like to talk about how we're using new technology to serve Americans of all ages, from children in our classrooms to seniors casting ballots in this year's presidential campaigns. And I also want to share some thoughts on a dual renaissance in two areas of our national life, public service and philanthropy, and how each is helping PBS overcome its obstacles. And I'll conclude my presentation with a special announcement, and then I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, and I see they're already rolling up to the front. Allow me to begin with a quick explanation of how public television works, because I find that even in audiences as sophisticated as this one, there's some misperceptions about what public television is and what PBS is in particular. To begin with, PBS is not a network. It is a membership organization comprised of more than 350 public television stations across America. PBS was created by the stations to provide the scale necessary to develop the programming, the online and educational content, and the technical infrastructure that no single station could create by itself. PBS stations are fiercely independent. They're autonomous public entities. Often, in most communities in this country, and I've traveled a lot in the 2 years that I've been in this job, I can tell you the PBS stations, and in fact the NPR stations, are the last locally owned media in the communities that they serve. Each station has its own manager and board of directors. Each one determines what it'll broadcast and what services it'll provide the community that it operates in. The one common thread that binds our stations is their commitment to serving local community. The stations that serve this greater Bay Area are a beautiful illustration of that ideal. San Francisco is the proud home of America's most watched PBS station in primetime, KQED. And together with sister stations KTEH and KCAH, KQED defines localism through community partnerships, educational outreach, and a robust lineup of homegrown productions like California Connected, Quest, and the Bay Window documentary series. For KCSM in San Mateo, localism means inviting the community in to suggest ideas for programs and helping viewers create their own media through a project they launched this year with their annual high school filmmaking festival. And for KRCB in Sonoma County, localism means meaningful partnerships with community schools and a commitment to helping adults complete their high school education through their GED Connection program. These are just a few examples of how these stations serve their communities. And ironically, the head of these three stations are sitting in the front row, Jeff Clark, Marilyn Lawrence, and Nancy Dobbs. And if you want to learn more about their stations and how they work with their respective communities, please speak with the three of them. I know they would love to tell you what's going on at home. Localism demonstrates public television's greatest distinction in our area of consolidated corporate-owned media. But another way in which we differ from our commercial partners is that we depend on our viewers for our financial support. Individual donors are, in fact, public television's largest source of funding. Every year, millions of Americans sit down at their kitchen table and they write a check to their local PBS station. And I have a hunch that there are a number of people in this room that have coffee mugs, tote bags, and bumper stickers to prove it. This isn't how public broadcasting works in most other parts of the world. That other great broadcaster, public broadcaster in the United Kingdom, for example, the BBC, is funded by a tax on television sets. In the United States, our viewers choose to give us money. We also receive some funding from the federal government. Actually, it amounts to about 15% of our funding, of our overall funding. We treat the federal funding as seed money, and we leverage that money many times over to provide programs like Sesame Street and Reading Rainbow and the NewsHour and Nova and Great Performances and American Experience, the kind of programming that I argue you won't find anywhere else. Our shows help our viewers explore the world, taking them places and showing them things that they wouldn't experience otherwise. For Americans of all ages, PBS is this trusted guide on the path of life. Perhaps it's then no surprise that we are, in fact, one of the nation's most trusted institutions, and I'm not just making that up. For the past 4 years, the annual survey by the respected Roper Research Organization has ranked PBS as number one in public trust. In other words, more Americans trust PBS than courts of law, major newspapers, the commercial networks, even Congress. Of course, some may say our friends on Capitol Hill haven't set the bar that high. But three-quarters of the public consider PBS an excellent or good value. And in the most recent poll, for the very first time, we actually tied with the military as the best use of taxpayer dollars. Now, why am I saying that to all of you? Because I take enormous pride. As my friend and colleague Ken Burns says, PBS may have nothing to do with the actual defense of our country. It just makes our country worth defending. And yet, it has never been harder to do what we do. Today, we are challenged on every front. In Washington, we face enormous competition for funding. Public broadcasting has always enjoyed bipartisan support, but like every public service, like schools and libraries, museums and hospitals, we have found the federal budget is stretched tighter than ever. We also face enormous competition across the television dial. Commercial networks like CNN and Fox News, Nickelodeon, Disney, Discovery, the History Channel, they all try to emulate what PBS does. Actually, I like to think they emulate the brand rather than emulate the actual content and quality of what we do. Of course, there is one key difference between what they do and what we do. They exist to profit from the public. We simply want to serve. And that's why you find shows on the History Channel like Ice Road Truckers and Smash Lab on Discovery. The competition, I think, is at its most fierce along the digital frontier, and that's where old and new media clash in a 21st century range war. It's virtually lawless territory, a place where the weapons aren't six-shooters, but iPods, cell phones, and other gadgets that put the consumer in control of what they watch, where they watch it, and how they watch it. The digital frontier is where blogs, YouTube, and MySpace are a top source for news and information, a place where Obama Girl has as much prominence as Diane Sawyer, Katie Couric, or even our own Judy Woodruff. And the digital frontier is where television will be reborn on February 17th, 2009, exactly 400 days from today. That is the day, and if that day doesn't have any significance to you, let me tell you it is one that should, because that is the day when the government will require television broadcasters to shut off their over-the-air analog signals and replace it with over-the-air digital signals exclusively. It will represent the biggest change in television since color sets became widespread in the 60s. And what does this mean to you? Well, if you now watch television through a cable box or through satellite television, you don't have to worry and you can stop listening to me. Actually, you need to listen to me, and I'll explain why in a minute. If you have a brand new digital television set with a digital tuner, you don't have to listen to me right now. But if you still watch television on a rabbit ear set, and there are lots of Americans that do, you'll need to do something before February 17th of 2009 to continue watching television. You'll need to either plug into cable or satellite. You'll need to buy a new set, or for a very small fee, $40 to be exact, you can get a tiny little box that you can plug into the back of your set, and your set will convert the digital broadcast signal into analog. And by the way, the federal government is issuing $40 coupons, so it's actually basically free. If you get the coupon from the federal government, you can get two boxes per household, and you continue to can watch over-the-air television. Now, some of you may be sitting here thinking, well, who watches over-the-air television anymore? Well, industry research indicates 20 million households, that's not people, 20 million households receive over-the-air TV signals exclusively in their homes. And an additional 15 million households have secondary over-the-air sets that are in kitchens, that are in dens, that are down in the basement, that are in kids' rooms. Since many of our viewers watch over-the-air television, we are very worried about the change, and we are very worried about the public policy implications. We have a digital divide in this country. I don't have to tell anyone sitting in this room that. And although some may argue it is not as broad and as deep, I believe that there are large pockets of our country that don't have access, particularly the elderly and the poor, people in rural communities that lack access to the internet and lack access to other new technology. And that's why television remains such an important medium. Every household may not have a computer, but almost every home in this country has a TV set. So for these Americans, TV is not just entertainment, it's a lifeline. These Americans may not be able to log on to the internet to read the latest news on the presidential race or upload a debate question that's been posted to YouTube, but they can turn to their TV set, to a news program to learn more about the campaign. And then there are many Americans for whom television really is a lifeline. Citizens whose vision or hearing is impaired, they rely on television not only for news and entertainment, but also for emergency alerts. That's why it is essential that lawmakers, regulatory agencies, and industry leaders work together to educate and prepare the public about the DTV transition. Last month, a report by Congress's independent investigative arm concluded the government has failed to develop a comprehensive plan or strategy to measure the DTV transition's progress or results. We in public television want to work together with folks across the country to make sure that people are aware of this transition. We're calling for a grassroots educational campaign that will ensure that once the transition occurs, no viewer will be left behind. And so you look at all these issues, the funding challenges, the rise of new competition, the challenges of the digital frontier, and you ask yourself, can PBS survive? Is public television still relevant? Or, as the title of my speech tonight, do we have a place in a YouTube world? The answer to all these questions, in my mind, in the minds of my colleagues, and I hope in all of yours, is an unequivocal yes. The reason is that we are so much more than television. We always have been, and we always will be. You know, Edward R. Murrow famously said that television can illuminate and inspire, but only to the extent that humans are willing to use it to those ends. Otherwise, it's merely wires and lights in a box. PBS has never been just wires and lights in a box. We help America to be more. We do it through documentaries like The War, the masterpiece from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick that I cited earlier. We do it through news and public affairs programming that casts light, not heat, on the issues of the day. And we do it through the arts, bringing ballet, symphony, and opera to places in America that might not otherwise have an opportunity to see it. And we do it through our work in the schools. PBS and our member stations do a remarkable amount of work in the educational arena. We provide teachers with lesson plans and classroom video. We train teachers in key subjects like math and science, and we help educators teach disadvantaged kids to read. We do it because we measure success not by the number of products that we sell, but by the minds we open, the hearts we touch, and the lives we change. We don't have to satisfy shareholders on Wall Street. Our shareholders are on Main Street. We answer to the American people, and that is why we bear a unique responsibility to work together with organizations like this one to ensure that we have an engaged and enlightened American citizenry. Today, we strive to fulfill this special commitment to the public through television, but we're also staking out territory along the digital frontier. On TV, PBS remains the home of the most trusted names in journalism, Jim Lehrer, Judy Woodruff, Gwen Ifill, Bill Moyers, Charlie Rose, Tavis Smiley, and the teams at Frontline and Now. These people and programs make a difference. Reporting by Frontline has led to tougher worker safety regulations, tougher enforcement of anti-torture laws, and a UN resolution calling for a ban on toxic waste dumping in the third world. Last season, Bill Moyers earned near universal acclaim for his expose on the role of the press in the run-up to the Iraq War. And after President Bush watched an episode of a program produced here by KQED, Jean-Michel Cousteau's Ocean Adventures, that depicted the northwestern Hawaiian Islands' struggle against pollution, he declared the region a national monument. This election season, PBS is offering extensive coverage across each of its signature series. We made history last year when we broadcast Tavis Smiley's All-American Presidential Forums, the first time journalists of color came together to question major presidential candidates. Charlie Rose has been conducting extensive interviews with the candidates while the team at Now has been focused on a story often overlooked, the integrity of the voting process itself. Now's story includes exposés on voting machines, ID cards, and voter suppression. Meanwhile, the NewsHour is planning a 24 hours of live, high-definition coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions, allowing PBS to devote more airtime to these events than any other broadcaster. And Frontline will continue its traditional The Choice, profiling the major candidates, whoever they may be, and that show will air in late October and again on the eve of the election. But for all of television's power, it remains at its heart a one-way medium. Our newest Nobel laureate, Al Gore, explored this idea at length in his most recent book, The Assault on Reason. Mr. Gore suggests that television represents society's transition from the printed word to the internet. He writes, individuals receive but do not receive. They listen but do not speak. They are given information but do not share it in return. They do not comment on it in ways that others can hear. On the other hand, he writes, the internet is the most interactive medium in history with the potential to help redeem the integrity of representative democracy. Public television shares that view. Last week, PBS launched a beta version of PBS Engage, a major public affairs and social media initiative. PBS Engage will use all the tools of social media, blogs, forums, tagging, user-generated video, to help citizens engage in the world around them. I believe it has the potential to become a real force in the democratic process, and I urge each of you to check out the beta site, which is just launched at pbs.org/engage. And please give us feedback. We're asking for it as we build this site out. Beyond Engage, we offer comprehensive companion websites for all of our television series, from our public affairs programming to other signature shows like Masterpiece Theater and Sesame Street. And PBS.org, by the way, is one of the most visited .orgs on the Internet, actually passed only by Craigslist and Wikipedia. Not bad. PBS also gives its viewers the opportunity to download episodes of their favorite programs at websites like iTunes and Juiced. And we're seizing upon the digital television transition, treating it not as a threat, but as an opportunity to expand our services. After all, digital television not only gives us better pictures and sound quality, it allows us to offer more content than ever. Many of our stations, including our stations here in the Bay Area, have started offering digital channels like World, and which is devoted to public affairs programming, and Veme, which offers round-the-clock programming for Spanish-speaking audiences. And yes, PBS is even on YouTube. We have uploaded 700 clips to the video sharing site, including Bill Moyers interviews, frontline investigations, and clips from the war, and pieces of the complete Jane Austen marathon that began running this week. PBS has become one of YouTube's most popular channels, with 3,000 subscribers and almost 100,000 channel views. Many of our stations are working along these same lines. Here in the Bay Area, KQED offers Quest, a multimedia, environmental, and science series that includes an interactive website, a weekly high-definition television show, radio segments, and a major educational component. Quest is, I think, KQED's most ambitious local offering ever, and a model for the successful integration of television, internet, and other media. In fact, I'm told that last August, more people watched Quest online than on television. We have that actually same phenomena playing out nationally with our kids' series, Cyber Chase, where kids are spending — this is a half an hour kid show that kids learn math skills. Kids are spending an hour, close to an hour online playing Cyber Chase with a larger audience, and as playing games are learning math skills. It really shows where technology is helping PBS redefine itself. But I think that's only part of the interesting times that we're living in now. At the beginning of my comments, I made reference to the fact that there's a dual renaissance unfolding in two areas of our national life, public service and philanthropy. And it's such an interesting time. It's an interesting time to be at PBS. It's an interesting time to be in any public service organization. You know, we saw the renaissance in public service this month in Iowa and again in New Hampshire, when record numbers of voters were turning out, fulfilling our democracy's most basic and cherished act of citizenship. But we also see evidence in the renaissance in the surge in volunteering. The United States is experiencing a revival of the kind of civic idealism that we haven't seen since President Kennedy ushered in the new frontier in the early 1960s. Consider this. More than 61 million Americans spent 8.1 billion hours volunteering in 2006. 27% of all Americans volunteered last year, in 2006, a near record high and a level not seen in decades. Meanwhile, the number of incoming freshmen who are starting college with volunteer experience has surged. Now, I hope that's not just so that they get into college. And applications to volunteer in service to America and the Peace Corps are soaring. The renewed emphasis on public service in this country is palpable, and so it's an exhilarating time to be working in the nonprofit sector. And our fellow citizens aren't just donating their time. They're digging deep into their pockets, too. People like Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett, and others are reinventing philanthropy. The Chronicle of Philanthropy reported last year that there were two charitable donations of $100 million or more by individuals in 1996. By 2006, that number had risen to 21. These are annual contributions of $100 million or more. So 2 years ago, I was involved with Mary and with Peter Hero to form the PBS Foundation. This foundation is an independent organization that helps elicit philanthropic support for PBS, enlist, I should say, philanthropic support for PBS at the national level. We've raised $19 million so far, and we're using that money to help fund public affairs programming and new education initiative. My goal is to use the foundation to identify those philanthropists with the passion and the means to help PBS strengthen its commitment to the cause of citizenship, public service, and education. Ultimately, I want the foundation to build an endowment that will help insulate public television from the volatility that stems from government funding. And now I want to quickly say, and not just because I have my three station managers sitting in the front row, that of course the most important thing for you to do is support your local station. I'm talking about large-scale contributions of national scale. And to that end, I'm pleased to announce we're taking another great new step. Today, one of the great corporate citizens of Northern California, Adobe Systems, announced it will donate $1 million to the PBS Foundation. The grant is going to support the establishment of the Adobe Youth Voices Venture Fund, which will help PBS develop and distribute innovative new content for America's young people. It's another example of how we're striving to serve our audience in imaginative new ways. So as we cast our eyes towards tomorrow, we recognize the obstacles we face: funding challenges, increased competition, and a technological revolution that has given rise to a freewheeling digital frontier. But we also recognize that while the future offers uncertainty, it offers enormous promise, too. We are working hard to put new technology to work for us and to take advantage of a surge in public service and a renaissance in philanthropy. We remain committed to providing public affairs content that treats viewers with intelligence, shows and specials that go beyond the superficial soundbite to provide a deeper understanding of the world around us, and we remain committed to the other things PBS is known for: quality children's content, lifelong learning programs, arts and cultural programming that bring ballets and symphonies and operas to places in America that might otherwise not have the opportunity to see them. Our successes, including our new gift from Adobe, are encouraging, but we still have a long way to go. So let there be no doubt, PBS will survive and thrive in a YouTube world. So whether you find us on a TV set, on a computer screen, on an iPod or on a cell phone, in a classroom, or working alongside you in the community, the result will always be the same. As I said before, we touch hearts, we open minds, and we change lives. We have been a guide on the path of life, helping Americans of all ages explore their world, and we look forward to continuing this important work for many years to come. Now, whenever I speak and travel around the country, I always try to tell a story of how PBS has touched someone's life, because I think that that's the best way to really capture the work that we do. And I'll tell one very quick story, and then I'll open the floor for questions. Or actually, I'll turn it over to you, Robert. And that is, during our work this past year on the war, I was part of an event that happened in Washington. We had a plane load of World War II veterans that flew to Washington from Arkansas. They came along with the team from Arkansas that had worked for the last few years on a mammoth oral history project capturing the stories of these extraordinary men and women. And for those that have been following all the coverage about the war over the course of the last months, you are well aware that this is a generation that is dying at an alarming rate. And so the ability for public television and our stations locally to try to capture these stories is tremendously important, because it's a part of our history that is just slipping between our fingers. The group did a series of events while they were in Washington. Ken and I spoke to them at a breakfast. They went to Arlington Cemetery. They went to the National Cathedral. They went to the World War II Memorial. And they went to the Holocaust Museum. And at the Holocaust Museum, for those that have gone through, when you go through the very end, there is a very powerful display of shoes. And the two of the GIs, former GIs, were standing next to the pile of shoes, and they were talking to each other. And they noticed that there was a man that was standing about 6 feet away that kept staring at them. And these two men had been liberators of a camp. And the man slowly walked over, and he looked at them and said, "I want to shake your hand. I was in the camp that you liberated." This is the kind of connection that we try to make on a day-to-day basis. We try to bring history to life, and we try to connect people to one another. That's why the work that we do, and for those of us that work in public television, whether as staff or as board members or volunteers, take our work so seriously. And so that's why I'm so very grateful to have the opportunity to be with you here today and to share a little bit of the story of what we try to do each and every day, each and every week, each and every year. Thank you so very much.
Our thanks to Paula Kerger, President and CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service, for her comments today. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and I will be moderating today's audience question period. Ms. Kerger, we have a number of questions, so are you ready to begin?
Yes. They're okay. Sending me back over here.
Okay. Study after study shows that public television programming has no liberal slant and isn't seen as biased. Yet that charge is still out there, and I believe you take it seriously. What is your proper response to that, or what would be the response?
Well, we do point to the polls that I think the questioner is referring to that indicate that we do take very seriously our mission to show all sides. I used to run a station in New York, and we took very seriously the feedback from the community. One of the things that I did when I would come into the station in the morning is I would look at the overnight comments, and a lot of them were generated from programs like the NewsHour, and particularly News and Public Affairs seemed to generate that immediate response. And there were many mornings when I would sit at my desk and wonder if the people that had all called in the night before were watching the same television show. Some thought that we had been too liberal, some thought we had been too conservative, some thought that we had been too easy, some thought we had been too hard. And those were the days that I thought we probably hit the mark because we upset everyone on both sides. But we look very carefully at our program schedule, and we look to try to make sure that we do have a diversity of viewpoints, and that is a commitment that is deep, and we continue to look towards our stations to give us feedback. We have programming panels that give us feedback, and we frankly listen to our viewers, and I know that this will surprise many of you, but our viewers are hesitant to call and email. That's a joke. We hear from lots of you. Not just in the Bay Area. We hear from lots of you around the country.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of the process for programming, you know, how you decide what's going to be aired, and also about some of the more popular shows or shows you think you air just because you think they're important?
Yeah. We get programs from lots of different places. In fact, I see Sally Jo Pfeiffer, who's sitting in the back of the room, who brings us Independent Lens and runs ITVS here in San Francisco and shares the great work that she does with the rest of the country. Programs come into our schedule lots of different ways. We do run the gamut from programs like Masterpiece Theater that have been on the air for many years that are established series to, frankly, we have programs in our schedule that have been funded by people's credit cards and that make their way to us. We have a program team and that vets programs that we work with a lot of independent filmmakers for those that are looking to work in public television or see their work displayed on public television. And I encourage anyone who is a filmmaker who is interested in doing work for us to go onto our website. We have a section that walks you through the process of how to submit work and at what point. We get work at different stages. There are times that we are pitched ideas. We have given small grants to have ideas fleshed out if there's something that we're interested in and looking for. And we're constantly juggling, as you made reference, to programs that have slightly broader appeal, to programs that maybe won't be seen anywhere else. And then, of course, local stations are also looking to tell important local stories. And I know here the public television stations that serve this community spend a lot of time trying to make sure the voices from this community are very much a part of the work they do. One of my interests right now is in the performing arts and the visual arts. I think that if you look at what is out there on commercial television and on cable television, and I feel like I need to say quickly, I am not blasting cable or commercial television. There's wonderful programming that exists there. But their whole purpose, as I said in my prepared remarks, is different than ours. And so they develop their content a little differently. But one genre of program that has disappeared from television is arts programming. I grew up watching, as I think many of you did, Ed Sullivan Show that had opera singers and variety programs that had a real breadth of music. And I remember watching Edward Villella dancing the Nutcracker on television. That is all gone except for public television. And we struggle to keep it there because of the cost. I've begun a major initiative to try to build out the work that we're doing in the arts because I think it's tremendously important. We started last year with a partnership with the Metropolitan Opera, and that has really started us down a path where I'm hoping we can expand and do more work in both performance as well as visual arts.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Paula Kerger, President and CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service, better known as PBS. What do you consider your competition? Is it just people's time? Is it other medium? When you sit and plan your content, what do you talk about?
You know, it's interesting. I think that for a number of years we looked at other broadcasters as our competition. And we looked very hard at what they were producing and tried to balance the work we were doing that we didn't see others picking up, which is, in fact, my interest in the arts as one example. But now I think that more and more we are looking at all of the competition for people's time. It feels to me, and perhaps it does to you as well, that we live in a time where we are so overscheduled and overcommitted, and time is our most precious commodity. And so now I feel that we are not just trying to break out of the fray of other broadcasters and try to make sure that people know the work we're doing, but we're also competing against all the other, you know, toys from iPods to internet use to other media to just the business of life. And that's why, from my perspective and the perspective of our colleagues, we are very interested in making sure that no matter how you consume media, I used to take the train a lot between Washington and New York, and I would sit on the train and look at people in front of me with their laptops that were watching television programs. At the time, I thought, oh, well, this is interesting. This will sort of fade away. It hasn't. It's accelerated. So I think for us, for our producers that have important stories to tell, what's important is that we get those stories out in as many places as we can. And so we're working in partnership with our local stations to make sure that they have the capacity to build their work out as well, so that whether it's posting clips on their website or posting clips in other places, we have the material where people can find them.
Okay. You talked quite a bit about the transition from analog to digital, and you mentioned the 400 days, which sounds pretty like a title of a book, maybe. But what lies ahead?
It does sound like the title of a book, doesn't it?
But what lies ahead? Is it going to be really a political, a marketing, a business campaign for the country, for the industry, and what can PBS do to help the process, and who will gain most from it?
Well, it's interesting. Obviously, the cable companies have been out for a while. In fact, you probably have seen the ads that they're running with a very nice, sweet elderly woman telling you that you don't have to worry about it. All you have to do is call your cable company, and they will take care of everything for you. And cable is, in fact, an option for people that want to, to expand their TV viewing. But I think it's really important for people to understand they have other options. And I think that there is a big misperception and I think a gross underestimation of the number of people that rely on over-the-air television. And so the federal government has begun to step up a little bit. Organizations like the National Association of Broadcasters have begun to feed out spots. We're working with our stations to do a couple things. One is to put material together that stations can broadcast, can put on their websites, can put in the mail that they send to their constituents. We're encouraging organizations. There are a lot of service organizations all over the country, and perhaps this is one yet another example of this interest in volunteerism and community that is going to be helpful, because I think we just need to reach out. I think of my mother-in-law, who passed away 2 years ago, who loved television and who had the old set, and we could never talk her into upgrading into even to a cable box. She liked her old set with the rabbit ears. It worked just fine. Thank you. She would not be able to figure out how to do this on her own, I don't think. And so there are, I'm sure, lots of families that will help their elderly parents figure this out, but there are a lot of people who I worry that are homebound that will never figure this out. I worry about people that will be nervous about reaching out to the federal government for information and access. And so we are different than any other broadcaster because we're in every community in this country. And we have volunteers and presence in every community in this country. And so our stations are starting to gear up to try to get the word out. And then I'm using opportunities, obviously, like this one, to talk about it, because I think the more people are informed and they know that this is an issue coming forward, they will not only think about it for themselves, but they'll think about it for those that are close to them that are relying on over-the-air television.
Every so often, out of Washington becomes a conflict between PBS and various politicians. Can you talk a bit about how you deal with that and the relationship, how you might describe with the current administration as you look ahead? Is there anything you would look forward to in terms of a new administration?
We have, as I commented on earlier, we do receive bipartisan support, but there are moments in our history, it seems to be every 7 years, for some reason, it comes back like the locust. We seem to have problems with someone that takes issue, I think many times with a program that we've done or a series of programs that we've done that have decided that this is an opportunity to defund us. And the threats have been real. And I am guessing, as I look around this room, that there are some of you that have been part of the efforts to maintain funding for public television and public radio. And it's been, you're the ones that have saved public television and radio. It hasn't been me, and it hasn't been any of the people that work in our business, as brilliant as I think we are at the work that we attempt to do each and every day. We exist because the people in our communities want us to exist. If you didn't want us to be here, we would go away. We are largely supported by individual philanthropy, and our federal funding has been maintained because each and every time there has been an issue on the Hill, people from around the country have risen up, parents, children, senior citizens, moms and dads, and people that have lots of stuff going on in their life, and they've contacted members of Congress and have made it known that public television is an important part of society. And that's what's kept our funding strong. And I can tell you the last round of battles that we had on the Hill, that and that alone was what turned it around. Congressional offices were overwhelmed with phone calls and letters and emails. And it made the pivotal difference. And so we try not to cry wolf too much. When we have problems, we tell you. And because we feel that we have this partnership with the communities we serve, we think it's important that you know when these things happen. But I also encourage on an annual basis, if you have relationships with members of Congress and you feel that public television is important, tell them. It never hurts for them to be reminded of the role that we play in our communities. So where do we sit now? We ended up this year with a slight cut in our funding. Everything that we're funded out of the labor, HHS, and everything in that bill was cut by a certain percentage. And so we did get a slight reduction in our funding, and we considered it a victory that we weren't cut deeper. We look forward to a new administration and hopefully building relationships that will enable us to not only continue the work we're doing, but hopefully expand it. The challenges on us are enormous. We are no longer operating just one single program stream in the communities we serve. We're operating multiple broadcasts. We're trying to deepen our work in the schools because we think it's important. We're trying to expand the work that we're doing online. And we are absolutely stretched. And we see big areas of content that we produce that both on the TV and the radio side, particularly in areas like international news, that we don't see anyone else picking up. And so we think that it's tremendously important that we continue to press forward and make our case, and we look forward to working with wonderful people like you to try to argue that out.
How does your funding break down between the government, individuals, and corporations? And is it, in terms of the total amount, where is it trending?
That's a really good question. The largest piece of funding that we receive is individual support, and it ranges from station to station, how much money comes through individuals and how much money comes through corporate. But it, in order of significance, individual philanthropy, then corporate, then the federal government in terms of dollars. In terms of federal government, we've been flat. We've been flat for a long time. And every 7 years or so, there's an attempt to eliminate our funding, and then we sort of work to bring that up a little bit. In terms of corporate support, that has been relatively flat. And in terms of individual philanthropy, that has increased slightly. So we are, working hard to increase particularly the support from individuals, because that's where we feel our real relationships are and that's where we feel our ties are.
How do you, you're in a unique position where you both get funding from the federal government and you have issues there, but also the potential perception of influence, I guess, from corporate funding. I mean, how do you wrestle with that in terms of your programming or even the message you want to get out to the public?
Well, in terms of programming, I would say that, and we do scrutinize the corporate support very carefully, not just there is no corporate influence in the work we do. We have an absolute firewall between our editorial and the money we raise. I worry a lot about the perception of corporate influence as much as I worry about the dangers of corporate influence, because I think that because we are an organization that exists because of the trust that we have built with the American public, I think if that trust is violated, we would shutter our doors. I think that is that profoundly important. Corporations are interested in programs of a certain type. They tend not to be as interested in programs that are controversial. Those are largely funded by foundations and individuals and our discretionary money. So I think that in terms of how does it sift out, corporations tend to be interested in programs of sort of general interest. And having said that, there are wonderful corporate citizens who have supported very big and bold programs, so I shouldn't make such sweeping generalities. But I think for the most part, what we try to work very hard at monitoring is how we actually assign corporate value to their participation, so that people don't question the work that we're doing and do recognize that we do pay attention to this.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program with Paula Kerger, President and CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service, better known as PBS. Can you talk a little bit about what the public's favorite programming is, what yours is? And you mentioned the
arts.
That's,
the most dangerous question of anything that you've asked me tonight.
It's also softball. Come on.
You don't have to live with the producers.
That's true. But also, I mean, you mentioned the arts, but are there other areas in the future you'd like to see programming expand?
The most popular program on public television in the last 10 years was Ken Burns' The War. His work is always tremendously popular. And on an ongoing basis, the most popular weekly program on public television is Antiques Roadshow. But also programs like Nature and Nova are tremendously popular. Last night, we broadcast the beginning of our Jane Austen marathon on Masterpiece Theater. For those that have not realized yet, we are running all six film versions of all six of Jane Austen's novels, and a biography of Jane Austen will run all throughout the winter and spring. And so if you love Jane Austen, in fact, when I was flying out today from Washington, one of the two films on Jane Austen that was created actually was on the plane coming across. You realize how much Jane Austen has become a part of a lot of interest. In fact, I think that there are a surprising number of if you go on to online and type in Jane Austen, you get a surprising number of hits. And I forget the number of Facebook relationships she has, but it's huge. So go figure. But anyway, I'm dodging the question about what's my favorite program. But it's like trying to say what's your favorite child. You know, you don't really have one. But I am very interested in the arts. I am very interested in trying to really increase our work in news and public affairs, and some programs that like the News Hour, which I do rely on every night on the one end of the night, and Charlie Rosentav's Smiley on the other end are tremendously important to me, as are programs like Frontline and Now and Bill Moyer's Journal. I think they are unique, and I think that they attempt to tell the stories that people either don't want to tell in other broadcast media or don't see the value of telling. And so I think those are tremendously important. And the other area that I care a lot about is the work that we do for an audience that is our largest, and I haven't actually spent any time talking about tonight, which are those that are at the youngest end of our viewing audience, those under five. We put a tremendous amount of effort into the work we do for children. And most of our stations run 7 or 8 hours of children's educational programming every day. And it is a big part of what public television's heritage has been and continues to be. And as commercial broadcasters look at children as consumers at a younger and younger age, I think it's tremendously important that we're there, that we're in that space, and that we're trying to think of ways to help kids become ready to enter school, ready to learn, and ready to engage.
You mentioned earlier time is maybe your biggest competitor, but can you describe a little bit about what your demographics of your audience are? Is it shifting? Do you see it growing somewhere and shrinking somewhere else?
We actually, it's interesting because I think a lot of people think of public television, and I think they have a notion of what the average public television viewer is like. And in actuality, you know, we touch people across the spectrum. If you look at an analysis of our audience is reflective of the diversity of this wonderful country. And we reach across all education levels, all socioeconomic levels, but we do have a very large audience that's under five. And we have a significant audience that's over 50, which I think is grossly underserved by the rest of broadcast media. But we do cover everyone in between. And so I'm reminded again and again that people that fall in that category between 5 and 50 are watching us, and they're watching us in pretty significant numbers. If there's one generality I can say about public television audiences is that they tend to be people that are more engaged. We have a large number of people who are teachers that use us on a regular basis, not just in the classroom, but are avid watchers of public television. And we have a lot of people that are active civically. Those are heavy users of public television. But we have lots of people that drop in to see us from time to time, whether it's for the News Hour or whether it's for Antiques Roadshow or whether it's for big events like Ken Burns' The War, which brought in a very large audience. We had a large audience for Jane Austen last night. Now, we were opposite American Gladiator. For those that think that society has gone down a certain path, there are a lot of people that are looking for alternatives. I actually believe that even programs like American Idol and Dancing with the Stars is not just about watching people humiliate themselves and getting voted off. I think part of it is also that there's no other outlet for people to see creative expression. Look at the Bravo channel, which has done some really interesting work. Now, it's not art like it was originally conceived to be, but the success of programs like Project Runway and Top Chef, that's really not just about the drama that's going on behind the scenes. It's about creative expression. And I think that our country is hungering for that. And particularly when you look at what's happened in the schools, where in so many parts of the country, arts education just doesn't exist. I think creativity is so much a part of who we are as humans that to be able to foster that is so profoundly important. And that's why I'm interested in it as a part of what public television does.
Looking ahead to the presidential campaign, does PBS have any special plans you want to share with us or can in terms of the coverage or things you'd like to do differently from the last campaign?
Yes, we are doing a great deal of coverage through all of our ongoing series, and I think particularly the NewsHour on the television side is looking to bump up its coverage, not just on air, but also Jim Lehrer in the NewsHour, this is funny, I was talking to someone about this at lunch today, is also a very popular radio show. If you listen to the NewsHour, and if you're like me, I'm usually making dinner and listening to the NewsHour while it's on the television. It actually works pretty well as a radio show and a number of radio stations. Are you carrying it in radio? It's a really good radio program. It's also one of the top podcast downloads on a consistent basis. And so I always tease Jim Lehrer a bit about being a podcast superstar. You know, he and Britney Spears, who would have guessed? But the thing is, it really is, which also tells you about who's using iPods. It's not just, kids. So we are looking to expand that. We're actually working in partnership with NPR. And NPR has made an enormous investment over the past years, and particularly over the last few years, with the wonderful generosity of Joan Kroc, and has invested heavily in building up its foreign bureaus and really ratcheting up its news gathering operation, and has sadly benefited from the decline of print journalism, particularly in the Washington area. They've brought in some reporters from the Baltimore Sun, and as well as other print journalists that have joined their team. And we are looking to better use the reporting work that NPR has invested in on the TV side. And so we just launched a few weeks ago our election map, which is being done jointly by the NewsHour and by NPR. And we are, over the course of the next months, looking to do a whole series of events that will to really help to make sense of what is such a critically important time in this country's history.
Does PBS export its content around the world? You know, frequently we'll see BBC shows here. Do you do that, or is this something you could take advantage of to show a different version of America rather than Hollywood's?
We do a little bit, and actually we developed a partnership this year with our station in Boston, WGBH, produces a good deal of programming for public television, and they had begun to take some of their programs overseas, and so we are now working with them to take more of the programs that are developed by public television by other places besides just Boston to represent them overseas. I think that there is a couple opportunities there. One is there are a number of programs that we produce that have always been popular. Programs like Nature, for example, are very popular overseas. Some of the music programs we produce are popular. But the point of the questioner is a good one. We also represent some of what is best about this country, and it is a great opportunity to share that with the rest of the world.
Okay, I have to ask this. What happened to the amazing Mrs. Pritchard?
You mean the final episode without the resolution?
I don't know.
I'm going to give you the name of the producer, and you can ask the question.
Okay. That threw me off now. You mentioned the competition again, and we keep going back to this, but to me it's really fascinating because of the media glut and the sort of differentiator of PBS. But is your challenge different? It sounds like you're expanding into multiple mediums, but do you see like a major threat? You mentioned getting on YouTube, but are people's time commitment changing so much that it's a concern to yours? And how do you market really what you're doing beyond your natural audience?
Oh, I worry about it a lot because I also worry about, the thing that makes us different than any other media organization is the fact that we are organization of individual local television stations that come together. And that's great power. So we have achieved a certain amount of scale by doing work together. And the challenge of this media landscape is to try to figure out how to take advantage of all of these platforms to have content out there and to do it in partnership with stations locally. When I was in New York, I was involved in the fundraising for a number of programs. And, you know, we would work. You know, the series that we did a few years ago on Broadway, we worked on that series for 10 years. The filmmaker's children were toddlers when he started working on that film. They were adults when they went to the wrap party. Not quite, but they were clearly dating. And the thing is, you know, you put all of this effort and all of the scholarship and the work that we do and the programs we produce, which is what makes us different than, you know, than other producers who are creating programming more for entertainment purposes rather than for education purposes. And then, you know, in the old broadcast world, we would put all this effort into a program and it would broadcast once. And of course, we never, in public television, we never have the money to really advertise things much. So, you know, we were just sort of hoped that people would find us. And then the program would just sort of sail off there. And sometimes it would show up in VHS, and sometimes people would find it there. And you know, stations would reschedule plays of programs again. But, you know, we would get excited if we got a 3 rating on a program sometimes. And, you know, a 3 rating, it's, in broadcast terms, now, that's a pretty good number. Well, that means that 97% of the people watching didn't find your program. So, okay, so a 3 rating, you know, and you got 97% of the people that didn't find you. Now, some aren't that interested in what you're doing, but a lot of people are. And so I worry about the competition, but I'm more focused on the opportunity of it. And the opportunity to reach some of that 97% that didn't find it on its first pass and that have now been able to be exposed to it. And we're seeing it online. You know, the proverbial long-tail phenomenon about having content that sort of sits out there that people access over a very long extended period. Some of the most popular destinations on PBS.org are programs that are 5 years or more old. And so it's just the content sits out there and people find it and it's got great use in the schools and it's tremendously valuable. And so to be able to have material that's sitting out there, if you are a Frontline fan, for example, then you probably know that the last, more or less most of the last 4 seasons of Frontline is available in streaming video. And so you can go online and you can pull down a Frontline episode and watch it. In your home, whenever you want it. It's right there for you, free. And that is a great idea if you think about all the wonderful programs that we've created over the years to have them accessible so that you can see them when you want them and how you want them. So we are ready for the challenge. We're ready to try to figure it out and to step up. And I know our stations are excited about the possibilities as well. And we are determined to get to that promised land.
Okay. We're nearing the end of the program, and we're going to have time for one last question. And you sort of summed it up, but I want to give you an opportunity to really, if you would like to, address the real opportunities you see ahead for PBS and the difference you can make in this country.
Well, I think when you look at the work that we do, and it doesn't matter whether it's on an iPod or whether it's on a television screen or whether it's in a computer, the real heart of what we do is the content that we produce and the commitment that we have made to create programs of highest quality. And I think that on many levels, we serve the American public. I think the American public hungers for authenticity. They hunger. I mean, you're seeing these themes playing out in the election right now. They hunger for hope, they hunger for aspiration, they hunger for something that will uplift and transform us. And I think that's the role that public television has played over the years, whether it was Mr. Rogers buttoning his sweater and bringing our youngest audiences along and seeing the possibilities of the world around them to the other extreme, a story that I've told often because I think about this man every day, a guy in a soup kitchen in New York City who pulled me aside and thanked me for the work that we did because we were a window on a life that he once had. And we were able to give him access to great art and to great thought and to ideas. And so for those of us that you know, sort of struggle to keep this enterprise of public television together, those are the stories that we carry in our hearts. And that is the call, the clarion call, to move us forward to do the work that we feel is so tremendously important. All of this technology, they're just tools to help us reach more people. And so speaking on behalf of all of my colleagues in public television, I want to thank each and every one of you who play a part in the life of your local public television station. Your support is what keeps us alive. So thank you.
Okay. Okay. Our thanks to Paula Kerger, President and CEO of the Public Broadcasting Service. We thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.